This is the conclusion of the series on the book of Titus. It's been broken up into four parts. This one shouldn't take too long. Could take hours today, but we're not going to take too long doing it. I've only got 10 or 12 slides that we're going to go through. prior to this, we looked at this at the Bible study series. We started out a part one introduction about the background of where it was, where Titus was, where Paul was writing to Titus, and we looked at the island of Crete and what Titus was instructed to do. And then we looked at the next stage. We looked at the background of elders. What were they? Because Paul instructed Titus to go and make elders of those to serve the people. And this whole concept of what is an elder has been in other societies and cultures around the world. Part three, we went over the characteristics of elders. And the reason we went over this is because these are actually characteristics for all of us, because we are all destined to receive the inheritance that God has planned for us. So the characteristics of elders may be true for some now, but it's really true for everyone. And that's why we all need to know this, because those are expectations of everybody who is answering the call of God. And part four today are their instructions to specific groups. And so those specific groups are what Paul instructed Titus how to teach. And those would be, for example, that one group is older men. He also said younger men, gave specific instructions to older women, instructions for younger women, and instructions for those who were servants, Christian servants. And then their general application to citizens. What should we all be doing? And then there was this little warning in the ends about things that we should avoid. It sort of sounds like a parent that says, well, go have a good time. Here are the guidelines. Watch over these things. Don't forget, there are some things to avoid. So let's start out with in Titus 2 and verses 1 and 2. We read, but as for you, speak the things which are proper for sound doctrine, that older men may be sober, reverent, temperate, sound in faith, in love, and in patience. Well, sound doctrine, according to Strong's, is to have, and he's speaking of sound as in sound health, to be well in your body. And figuratively is to mean to be uncorrupt or true in doctrine. Now, we all know what it means to be sound in health, because we all have some various levels of unsoundness in our health, and we all would want to have perfect health, but that's not the way it is. And so we're talking about to be whole or wholesome as the kind of sound doctrine. So that's really a goal. That's an expectation. And so establish sound doctrine. And doctrine, of course, is the teachings of the church. Secondly, that the older man must be sober. And we're not talking here strictly about alcoholic consumption, because sober also refers to good decision-making that is done with a clear mind. And you can't make good decisions if your mind has a chemical influence on it. So the older men be sober. In other words, clear-minded, and of course, obviously not addicted to substances that would cause that lack of clarity. Then it says reverent. Now, Strong's tells us that means venerable or honorable. The King James uses the word grave, meaning serious, which is Strong says that's another word, is also serious. So we think of something that's irreverent. We think of something that's carefree or not very serious. And so an older man should be reverent. Then he uses the word temperate. Now, you'll notice that some of these have overlapping meanings to this, and there's a reason for that. Generally speaking, in the Bible, you will find repetition used for emphasis, and they will use different words for the same kind of concept. So now we look at the word temperate, and that may bring to mind back in the 1800s about the temperance movement in the United States, which ultimately wound up in the 1900s for prohibition. You know, they wanted temperance. They wanted the people because it was affecting society. Well, temperate really is, in Strong's, defines it as of a sound mind or sane in one's senses. Being temperate, not going too far one way or going too far another, being sane, looking at all characteristics, being able to curb one's desire or impulses. Also, Strong says self-controlled. Well, we all know that if somebody just acts continually on impulse, we say, well, they're not really very mature now, are they, if they're just going on impulse? So if you can you imagine an older man just acting all arbitrarily on impulse, people are going to say he's not acting his age. So the expectation here is that an older man then be temperate. Then it gives us this term sound in faith. Well, sound, as we've talked earlier about, is really being healthy. Healthy in your thinking, healthy in your faith. If we take a look at Matthew 24:12, it talks about, and then we move on to, well, first of all, sound in faith is really about healthy instruction. Are we able to tell others what we know? Be ready always to give answer of the hope that lies within you. So sound in faith. Are you secure enough in your faith? Then we go on to sound in love, meaning are we healthy in our charity as it's placed in some translations or in our giving? Now, and that's where we go to Matthew 24:12, which says, because of iniquity shall abound, the love of many shall wax cold. People don't have the love, and therefore they don't have the empathy or the sympathy or the compassion for others. And you know, it was many years ago. It was, I can't believe this was 24 years ago. I was at the feast in Wisconsin Dells. And there was a fellow I had known there. He was an old man. And he was had a motorhome and a campground. And I went out to, at his invite, to share the evening with the campfire of him and his wife. And he said, you know, it's taken him many years. But he said, I had to learn how to love. But in order to learn how to love, I had to be willing to learn how to accept being loved. And that was a particular struggle, that he was okay with working and helping with others, but he had a hard time himself about accepting how to be loved. And I thought, what an interesting observation that he made. So it's not just learning how to love others, but learning how to love yourself and allowing others to love you. So sound or healthy in faith and healthy in love. And then it gives us this last characteristic for older men is sound in patience, or we can think healthy in patience. Now, Strong's talks about this word, patience, as being cheerful or hopeful with endurance. I like that. That's kind of a positive way to saying, not begrudging, oh man, I can't wait for this to get over with, but rather kind of a hopeful or a cheerful endurance, like, well, pretty soon we'll be on to the next thing, or whatever that patience level calls for. Strong's also describes it as a constancy or an enduring patience, a waiting or a continuance. So an older man should have this as a guide or a goal or a hope to do things. But of course, this is what Paul is writing to teach for Titus to teach to the men as he's helping the congregations there. Then we go on to verse 3 in Titus chapter 2 and verse 3. Notice he says, older women likewise. This comment is really the same thing applies. What we just said about the men applies to the women as well. And why does it apply to the women as well? And as I'm quoting from the New King James, unless otherwise spoken today, that they be reverent in their behavior. So the King James says that there be in behavior as becomes holiness. Well, holiness means sacred to God, something set aside, something special. So you use those characteristics to live up to the expectations that God has. So reverent in behavior. Then it includes here not slanderers. Now, the legal current definition of English of slander is saying something that is untrue and harmful about someone else. And if you print it, it's called libel. Well, at this, you know, his earlier version was in 1611 when the King James was produced. Slander, it said, saying something that's untrue or unproven about somebody, and that's hurtful to them. Now, the problem is of course, sometimes we say, well, you shouldn't say something about somebody else, even if it's true, even if it hurts them, and so bad things are true. So, but that would not be slander, other than in the sense that there's no reason to hurt other people, and that violates other precepts that God has. If we look at Leviticus 19:16, you know, we know the word slander in the King James, they use the word false accusers. In Leviticus 19:16, you shall not go about as a talebearer among your people, nor shall you take a stand against the life of your neighbor. I am the Lord. Given too much wine, okay, so that's the next issue. But don't be a talebearer. Don't be telling false things, unproven things there. So then we go into the next expectation is not given to too much wine. And really this means an excess. Doesn't mean you don't drink any. In this context, it says, don't go to excess here for anything that's going to cloud your judgment. We read the same thing about the men earlier when it says older men, that they be sober. And then, interestingly, it says teachers of good things. And this phrase, teachers of good things, only occurs in one place in the Bible, and that's right here in Titus 2:3, what this teacher of good things are. Now, I have a an acquaintance who went from teaching at a regular school to teaching at the juvenile detention center. And he said, there's one thing about teaching at the juvenile detention center is you never have to worry about attendance because the deputy will bring all of the students there every day that they're there. And he said, so you have full attendance. But what he discovered was, is that in places of incarceration, whether it's jail or prison, they really become colleges for criminals on learning how to do other bad things. Well, what did you do? What did you get away with? How come they didn't catch you for this, but they caught you for that? And so forth. So teachers of good things is a very big contrast to teachers of things that are ungood, that are going to be bad. So the older women are expected to be teachers. Then we have this interesting verse 4, that they admonish the young women. Now, in King James uses the word teach the young women. The New King James says admonish. Strong's says that word teach or admonish means restore to one's senses, to moderate, to curb or control or to discipline, to do one's duty or to hold someone to their duty. So this is an expectation of older women that to teach someone else, meaning here specifically younger women, I find it interesting, restore to one's senses. Like, wait a minute, you're getting carried away here. Let's consider the reality. Let's consider the truth of the matter, or to control or curb or discipline or hold. Now, isn't this the same thing we read for the older men? Was the same thing. And the older women are to teach this same level of curbing wrong thoughts or wrong actions. And interesting that that Strong's also includes to hold one to his or her duty. In other words, reminding them that they live for a higher purpose. There's a higher duty. So the older women, accordingly in verse 4, they teach the younger women. Then we go, well, what do they teach them? And if we look at Titus 2, starting in verse 4, they admonish or teach the younger women to love their husbands. Now, this is a rare thing that you would have to teach a woman to love her husband. Now, there are obviously cases where that isn't so. But really, the thought is you teach them before they get married, the older women, this is the case, okay? Now, I have a daughter whose anniversary was 2 days ago, and another one was an anniversary, what, about 10 days ago, 10 days ago, okay? And they love their husbands. But sometimes it happens in marriages that the couple grows apart. And so it's really something you don't really have to say ahead of time because the emotion of the love comes naturally at the time. But can they sustain that? Does it have a good foundation? So really, this is really advice perhaps from the older women to young women who may not be married that says when this time comes, this is to love your husband, but here's how to do it. Now, and I've never had occasion to know of a woman who didn't love their children. And it says to love their children. In fact, one of my daughters had a baby here a month or so ago. And it's remarkable. Each time one of my girls has had a baby, did you know that that baby was the most beautiful, wonderful baby in the whole world? And there's never been a baby this nice before. Why, it's just the most precious, sweetest thing ever. And I heard this again recently. So normally you don't have to teach people to love their children. But what does it mean to love your children? This is really the characteristics of what the older women are. How do you do that? Do you tie them to a lamppost and hope somebody comes along and picks them up? What does it mean to love your child? Now, that doesn't mean sometimes we don't want to. That's not the point. That's part where we go back to being discreet and curbing your instincts. So it's really how to love husbands, how to love children. If we look in verse 5, Titus 2 and verse 5, we're looking at the word discreet. Interestingly, the writer is using different words here for some similar meanings. In Strong's, it's defined as of sound mind or sane in one's senses. So bringing someone to their senses, being sane, don't be irrational, be rational. Another meaning is curbing one's desires and impulses, self-controlled or temperate. Learning to be discreet, is really reaching for a high standard. The older women teaching the women to reach for a high standard. And then they follow that right up with the word chaste. And of course, chaste means pure from carnality or being modest. You're married, you don't have to go provoking other men for their interest. And now we see a society where apparently they don't even bother to get married in many cases. So, in other words, strive for purity, and it's, if we read the Ten Commandments, we're really looking to not commit adultery means against your future husband or wife as well, not just against if you're only accounts if you're married. Don't be impure against your future mate. So, chaste can mean pure from every fault. How hard is that? But that's a goal. That's what we should strive for. As this was decades ago, I got a call from a young man who was on business. He was out of state, and he said, "There's something wrong. I talked to my wife, and something is not right. And I'm concerned that she may be in trouble. There may be something wrong. Would you go see?" So I took another man with me, and I went to the home, and surprise, 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 the young woman who had had a baby recently, her husband's fears were correct. She was entertaining another man, and I'm flabbergasted as to how to deal with that circumstance. But she didn't have a particular faithfulness in mind. Her husband was out of town, so she invited another guy in, because after all, what he doesn't know won't hurt him, supposedly, right? Well, ultimately, it wound up in a divorce. Those indiscretions can have that consequence, and it has a result on the children for multiple generations. But it was a very sad thing to see up front, up close. And I do think that I told the other young man, I think I gave him a nice talk about how if he wanted to live a long and peaceful life, he should go away for a while, like a very long time. Never saw him again. So we look at then the next expectation that older women are to teach. And interesting, it says homemakers. Now, and Strong's includes this as domestically inclined. And this is the only place in the Bible where this is found, meaning to be domestically inclined. Now, I know very few wives who are not domestically inclined, and all you have to do is to go into their house, and their house will have the influence of everything that they've designed, what their color patterns are, what they want to do, and how they want to do it. And a man is taking his life in his hands if he wants to restructure that thinking. So I generally advise men to let it be. That's her world, and that's fine, and that's your good. That's a good support for you. That to be able to create an environment of comfort where she can be able to best express her love for her husband. And then we find one that often winds up to be controversial. It says, obedient to their own husbands. And notice it right after that, it says what? That the word of God may not be blasphemed. Well, if we take a look, there's another scripture that's somewhat similar in Colossians 3:18 about wives. Submit to your own husbands as is fitting in the Lord. In other words, if there's no conflict with what God's will is, what the Bible says, then you all ought to cooperate together. That's the whole idea. And a young woman must understand, just as should a young man or any age people, that cooperation is a key for marital happiness. So it's really, as Colossians said, they use the word submission here. And I would look at it like this. If you're coming up to a stop sign, am I angry that I've at the stop sign, and do I just drive through it because I can go wherever I want? Or am I cautious and I look around for cross traffic to make sure that nothing is coming, and then I stop and proceed accordingly? I'm submitting to the law. I'm doing that for my own benefit, not just for the benefit of the person when I drive through the stop sign that I could impact or hurt someone else. So really, it's really paying attention in a cooperative spirit. And of course, some people abuse this verse. But remember what it says in Colossians, as is fitting in the Lord. In other words, is it approving of what God in a godly relationship would have us do? So we've now gone to older men and older women, younger women, and then we take a look at younger men. And here again, it's repeated in Titus 2, starting in verse 6. Younger men have the same responsibilities as we've read for the others. Likewise, that word likewise right there, exhort the young men to be sober-minded. Where have we heard that? Making wise decisions without impairments. And in all things, showing yourself to be a pattern of good works. You know, this pattern of good works doesn't just mean something. And I'm recalling of when President Lincoln was running for office, and one of the constituents said, "Why should I vote for you?" And Lincoln said, "Haven't I chopped your wood, and I brought food to you when you were sick?" And I'm just paraphrasing here. "And I plowed and planted and harvested your crops when you were unable, and I lent you my horse when you were in need." And the constituent says, "Well, yeah, but what have you done for me lately?" Abraham Lincoln understood, you know, even the pattern of good works isn't always appreciated, but it's really the pattern that we're looking at. What is the heart? What is the pattern? Not, oh, I did something good once and I should get points for that, but showing a pattern of good works. And what is a good works? If we look at Strong's again, it's a model worthy of imitation. And others will say a morally noble Christian duty. So this pattern of good works is doing what Christ expects us to do. Then we have that are self-explanatory doctrine showing integrity. We've already mentioned that about the healthy teaching, because doctrine is teaching. Reverence or incorruptibility. In other words, not despoiled. And notice this is the longest list for young men. Sound speech that cannot be condemned. One who is an opponent who is an opponent may not be ashamed, having nothing evil to say to you. Now, I remember in high school that it seemed to be remarkable that when a young man was 16 and he got a driver license and he got a car, they would be in school soon thereafter explaining, well, I rolled my car last weekend, you know, or I had this wreck or I did this, because they weren't doing what? They weren't showing a pattern of good works. They were pretty careless with what they were doing and how they were doing. And it almost became some braggadocio about, well, I rolled two cars. Well, and I came out fine with it. I have a cousin, Wayne, who was a large-billed fellow, not a lot of room between himself and the steering wheel. And it was about 2 in the morning, and he was pretty well laced with alcohol. And he missed a curve about 3 miles from my place. And it's about 2 in the morning, and it was winter in Minnesota, January. So it was bitter, freezing cold. Went off the road, and he hit an approach, the front of the car. There was so much impact that the car went end for end the long ways 3 times as it flipped over the approach, landed in a snowy, icy field. But he was pretty well lubricated, and his joints were pretty well loose. Not a lot of room for him to go. He was fine. So he got out of the car, walked to the farmer's door, up to the farmer's door, and banged on the door at 2 in the morning. And the farmer got up and said, yeah, you can use my phone. This was long before cell phones. And so he called a tow truck, woke somebody up that he knew 3 miles from town, and they came out, hooked up the car, and drove off, leaving him standing there at 3 in the morning in the freezing cold. Farmer had gone back to bed, and he was 3 miles from town, took the wrecked car and put it in front of his mother's place, but didn't take him home. Now, the young man had to learn. He walked 3 miles in the bitter cold to get home. By the time the car was there, his mother got up, didn't see him, sees this wrecked car sitting on the street in front of the house. And of course, I know this because it was a family member, that, and when I read this verse, a sound speech that cannot be condemned, that one who is an opponent may be ashamed, having nothing evil to say of you. Well, in this case, poor guy was, it was true. You know what they said of him. Now, he was nice enough always to me. He was just out Terry hooting around. And so we should live our lives so that people can't tell those stories about us. Right? So that people have no claim against us. Now, of course, I'm sure that there's always something that can be told, but we'll do our best to avoid that. So that's the exhortation to younger men. And then we have a fifth group. Fifth group are the Christian servants. Now, if we take a look, this is often referred to as slaves. If we recognize that during this time in Rome, about 50% of those living in Rome were slaves. In other words, they were beholden to someone else. The Bible refers to bond servants, and Hebrew law required a slave or an indentured servant to be released after 6 years. In other words, in their seventh year, they could go free. In fact, that whole indentured servitude has that America, on early America, was contractually used when Europeans wanted to come to America, and they couldn't afford a ticket on a ship. So they would promise to work for somebody for 6 years, if in the seventh year they could go free, if their mentor or proprietor of a plantation or a farm in America or a business would pay their passage to cross the Atlantic, Then at the end of that period of time, the end of the 6 years, the proprietor would have to provide them with clothing and with tools so that they could go out, build their own house, and make their way in this new land. So what is this instruction here? It's exhort bondservants to be obedient to their masters, to be well-pleasing in all things. And what, of course, if we look at bondservants means, what is a bond today? Bond is an agreement to borrow money and pay it back. So a bondservant means you owe somebody something. It's a payback. And so not answering back. We've all raised children, so we know what answering back is like. They reach a stage where they're going to get to be independent, and you say something, and they answer back. Those who are teachers know that there's always that smart aleck student or three in the class who will answer back. And some of them are very clever. You got to keep from laughing. Others are rarely serious. So not answering back, if you owe your boss something and you have an agreement, then don't belittle them. Verse 10 in Titus 2, verse 10, not pilfering, but showing all good fidelity. Pilfering means stealing the little things. It's no big deal. He won't miss it or she won't miss it. And so, in my college years, I worked for McDonald's. This was a long time ago before McDonald's had indoor seating and no drive-thru. And the Golden Arches were part of the building. And they frowned on the employees eating the food, pilfering from the boss. And that's, you know, pilfering has gone on for a long time. I recently bought a cordless electric tool at Lowe's. And they had a big promotion. You buy this tool, you get this, the top of the line battery for free if you buy the tool. Okay, I need the tool. I want this free battery. I've got to do it now. We're at the deadline. And they went to get the battery, and there was no battery there. The manager of that department said, I'm sorry, we show three in inventory, but since we last checked the other day, those three have been stolen. That was a $140 item. It's small. It would fit, you know, thicker than my cell phone, but about that big. And he said, you know, basically they've been pilfered. Somebody, because they had them in storage, so somebody on the inside took their top-of-the-line little cordless tool batteries. But showing all good fidelity. Fidelity is another word for faithfulness. Showing faithfulness. If you're going to be faithful to your employer, is really the expectation. And why are we doing this? It's we're doing this to adorn the teachings of God or the doctrine of God. If you're going to be a Christian and you owe obligations to someone, you don't want to do like some of those indentured servants did that came to America. When they got to America, they got situated, and they decided they weren't going to hang around for the 6 to 7 years, they just skipped out. They went to another state, just walked away from their obligation, had no sense of obligation. And so we have that how we act as for our employer is really addressing how well we believe in the teachings or the doctrines of God our Savior. So beyond the Christian servants, we then have everybody, the citizens. In Titus 3, in verses 1 through 3, we have to remind people to be subject to the rulers and authorities, to obey, be ready for every good work. Now, I find this interesting. Of course, you don't obey to something that will lead to bad. Okay, so there's a difference there. And then it says to speak evil of no one. That doesn't mean you can't speak about their evil actions, but it's not up to us to condemn them eternally, that they have a hope to turn around. But to speak evil of no one, meaning that that person is evil incarnate. You know, they're growing horns and a tail and turning red and carry a trident. That's not our place. But we can call attention and sigh and cry and cry aloud and spare not about evil that people are doing. And then I found this, and then this characteristic, it says, to be peaceable and gentle, showing humility to all men. And the and this becomes a real challenge. We'll pull up the right verse here. If we take a look in Romans 12, in verse 17 and 18, verse 17, repay no one evil for evil, have regard for good things in the sight of all men. And then verse 18, if it is possible, as much as depends on you, live peaceably with all men. That's a really, really big concept. Because you notice the term, if it is possible. Now, we're expected, you know, to be peaceable. But some people, including some rulers, don't make it possible to be peaceable. And so, and this is acknowledged right here, that it's only insofar as we do. But sometimes the other person doesn't want peace, doesn't want to do it. So, does that mean we do the same thing? No, we have to be very, very careful. We are to live peaceably with all men, but recognizing that some people it's impossible to do that with. It's particularly difficult if you're married to someone who's impossible to live peaceably with. And that's a sad circumstance, and it's happened to many. And then verse 3, for we ourselves were also once foolish. Ouch. There's no exceptions there. Have we all made a foolish decision somewhere? We could have done better, and we had to pay a terrible price. Once foolish. Disobedient. We're talking about disobedient to God. Deceived. Going off in the wrong direction, thinking things that perhaps God didn't expect us to do, but we attribute to God. Or serving various lusts and pleasures, following our own heart, following our own mind, and as a result, we live in malice and envy. And that's a very unhappy life. How do you live peaceably then if you're serving only your lusts and pleasures, living in hate and envy, wishing that you had something somebody else had? We have the Ten Commandments includes a commandment on not coveting, wanting something that someone else has. Doesn't matter whether it is. Whether it's a spouse or a thing that they own or a lifestyle that they have. And today they teach envy in schools, class envy and separation and such like that. And then people are very unhappy, living in malice, living in anger from one another, hating one another. And we see it playing out in society today that people have a very difficult time living peaceably with all men when the other people don't want to live peaceably. So we have these instructions that Paul has sent to Titus. And then Paul, after speaking about how to teach these various groups, he said, and now here's some things that you don't want to do. You want to avoid. And in Titus 3, starting in verse 9, but avoid foolish disputes, genealogies, contentions, and strivings about the law, for they're unprofitable and useless. I could probably summarize this up real quickly by saying, choose your battles. Why would you contend with someone over things that are unprofitable and useless? What's the point? Okay. As the old saying goes, what is it? A person convinced against their will is of the same opinion still. We find it out on social media. You're not going to convince somebody with sound, reasoned, documented truth when they didn't get there. As Mark Twain said, you cannot convince someone with logic when they reach their conclusions by other means. So, that becomes foolish, foolish disputes. In genealogies, there are some religions and many civil matters that the inheritances are based on who's related to whom and what level, you know, in genealogies. For some, as we know, they can be baptized for their ancient ancestors. Well, which is, I thought was, I never did find that in the Bible, but apparently they have. But the debate about genealogies, we read a little about inheritances in Luke 12 in verses 13 and 14, what Christ said about that. He said, "Then from one of the crowd said to him, 'Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me.' But he," meaning Christ, "said to him, 'Man, who made me a judge or an arbiter over you?'" So Christ was unwilling to get into this, who inherits what, on the picking news. Now, I had an interesting letter, and this was a bunch of years ago, about a member not from this area, who said, "We have a blended family situation. What is the biblically correct way to take care of the estate when we have it?" And it got very complicated, because now you have families with hers and theirs for children. And it got very complicated for him. And he wanted to know what would be an appropriate way to process this, because he didn't want to fight. He just wanted to, what should he propose as a biblical standard for inheritance? And all I did was give him some of these verses, and then as to what the inheritance laws were in the Bible, and let it go at that. Because what happens when you have all these foolish disputes and they're unprofitable and useless? We then have a conclusion, or what a directive in verse 10, Titus 3 and verse 10, is reject a divisive man after the first and second admonition. They say first and second, meaning maybe he didn't hear you right the first time, maybe it was a misunderstanding, but after the second time, that ought to clarify things. This is really, you know, you don't want to get involved in something that is unprofitable and useless. Again, verse 10 goes on, knowing that such a person is what? In New King James, it says warped and sinning, being self-condemned. Or if they continue on in whatever they're attempting to do that you see as a foolish dispute, and you say, you know, I'd really rather not get into it. And they persist, because they're going to convince you, no matter what, of whatever XYZ theory that they have. And the world is full of them. We always know people that always have an idea that you're going, I can't believe somebody else thinks that. They're out there. You know, believing that the earth is held up by Atlas, who stands on the back of a turtle, which was the ancient Greek belief. Nobody ever wondered where the turtle was standing for some reason. I don't know. And the earthquakes are when Atlas shifted the globe. And then there are modern applications of all that. Because it's unprofitable and useless and divisive. Meaning avoid getting into these discussions. And short circuit, if you realize where it's going, say, you know, well, everybody's entitled to their opinion. Nice weather we're having. Now, Matthew 18, there's a discussion on how to deal with someone who's a divisive person. And what does it say at the end of that? And we can read, it's a long entry. In Matthew, it's, you treat them as you would an unconverted person. Well, how do you treat an unconverted person? Are you harsh and cruel and angry? No. You're kind and gentle, but you keep your distance regarding any contentious matters. In Proverbs 16, verse 7, in Proverbs 16, 7, when a man's ways please the Lord, he makes even his enemies to be at peace with him. Well, that's a pretty remarkable thought, that here if somebody is trying to argue with you, our job is to live the way God wants us to, so that even that contentious person will want to be at peace with us if we handle it carefully and gently. And so, back to Romans 12:18, if it is possible, as much as depends on you, live peaceably with all men, acknowledging that it's not always possible. So put yourself at distance from the foolishness accordingly. So what we have here in Titus 2 and 3 is the instructions of various groups about to older men, to younger men, older women, younger women, to Christian servants, or in that case, even slaves, and citizens, and then a list of things that people should avoid. And so that wraps up our four-part series on Titus, so that we have a deeper understanding of that book and the writing of Paul to Titus on the island of Crete.